So nice to have you back, Matt. After more than it was, it's been a 2 weeks that we.
Yeah. I think it's my stuff and your stuff. And yeah, now we're here now. So yeah, happy to be here again. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
And Matt, let's get started with what's going on right now between Israel and Hezbollah. And before going to what's going on between, considering these new bombings that Israel is doing, we had some sort of strange type of bombing that we haven't seen before in any type of battle in the world. Right. That was a pager bombing, walkie-talkies bombing. How did you find that? What's your understanding of that?
Well, it was pretty ingenious. You give credit where credit is due. The scale of the operation is just massive. And I think that's why a lot of us, when we first heard about this, thought it was, at first I thought it was a handful went off. And then when you hear the scale, when you're seeing the reports coming in, you're thinking this must have been some type of cyber attack. They must have had some ability to cause the battery to explode. And then people are weighing in saying, no, the battery can't explode like that. You know, whatever. I'm fortunate. I know how to use my phone, let alone how it works or anything like that. Right. But, but to the scale of it. And so you have to give credit where credit's due. And that's where it stops, in a sense that this was an act of terrorism. This violates international humanitarian law and laws of armed conflict in multiple ways. We certainly can go into that if you want. But you also look at it and you say, what was the point? What do they think they're going to get out of this? And I think this was a punitive attack. It was meant simply to harm, to hurt, to punish. They had to have game this out. They knew full well that, one, they didn't know who all 4,000 of these pagers and however many hundreds of walkie-talkies were going to be held by who, in what conditions, in what settings. They had to have known that. They didn't care. They had to have known that these pagers, these walkie-talkies, were used by doctors and nurses, by social workers, by ambulance drivers, by just civil administrators, and of course by family members. And certainly the young one of several children who were killed in these attacks. I mean, the story is that the beeper went off in the house. This little girl picked it up, brought it to her dad very dutifully, right? And it exploded and killed her. They had to have known this was going to happen, and that was the purpose. And then when you take the next step, okay, so what do you think you're going to achieve from that? Do you really think that the Lebanese, particularly the Shia, who Hezbollah represents, you really think that they're just going to say, oh, well, we're too scared now. We're going to give up. It's all over. Good job, Israel. You beat us. This only furthers the determination, the unity, and the anger of the Lebanese people, the people in the Middle East, and people around the world. This only further isolates Israel. So why did you do this then? Well, there's the one aspect of it that, okay, if it was part of a military campaign, the idea that you were going to have these pagers all explode and hit Hezbollah members as well as their healthcare network, really put a dent in their communications network, and then you're immediately going to launch into a military campaign, right? So the tubes are the rounds are going into the tubes, the aircraft are up in the sky, troops are about to cross the line of departure, and you press the button, all these things explode, anger and war. And this is a great opening move to confuse your enemy, to give to, that's not the way it worked, And the story is that the Israelis realized that their plot had been exposed, so use these things or lose these things. And now, of course, we're seeing they're trying to catch up with that, but they certainly weren't prepared. The IDF wasn't prepared to carry out the types of strikes you would think would be associated with an attack like this. So again, the purpose is, what was the purpose then? The purpose was punitive. It was punishment. And it was also for morale, for the members of the Israeli public who support Netanyahu, which is a pretty firm base he has. We don't see his numbers declining. In fact, the indications he's actually gaining in popularity. You're also having this cheered on by people in the West, particularly in Britain, and most especially here in the United States, where members of Congress are celebrating you know, and pundits in the media are exclaiming how this was the greatest counterterrorism targeted strike, only has been, and then completely lying about things. But the lies are all part of it, because was it last night or over the weekend, Benjamin Netanyahu gave a speech where he once again cites all the beheaded babies and the burned pregnant women and all the lies of October 7th. That's all part of it. This is one more lie of the war. So, yeah, it's punitive, and it causes a terror. And it boosters the morale of your people just in time, you know, for, you know, to give another push to get the U.S. involved in a war with Hezbollah and potentially a war with Iran, because that's ultimately the goal of the Israeli government is to have that take place, because that's the only way they can win this. And of course, the United States government, the Biden administration, doesn't want anything to do with that, because it would potentially be disastrous for their election chances, the Harris election chances in November. So you're seeing all these tensions that are just been exasperated and blown open. And now, of course, you know, if this is not the first stages of the war that we've been anticipating between Hezbollah and Israel for a year now, you know, I'm not sure what those opening stages are going to look like, because these last few days have been pretty intense.
Do you find it? How did you find the outcome on the part of, we had Nasrallah talking about the attacks, and how did you find his speech and the way he was responding to the attacks on the part of Israelis? Do you think they're backing down, they're finding their strategy, they're just thinking on how to respond, or they know what they're gonna do?
Well, in terms of Nasrallah's speech, you know, he made it clear that this was there would be retaliation. That this is only going to further unify the Lebanese people. I think it only further unifies people around the world. I mean, certainly, we talk about the Turks a lot here. And certainly, I know this had to move the Turks to another level. The Turks have to be considering, okay, as the Turks try to and the Syrians come to some degrees of rapprochement, right, as they're trying to heal what occurred over the last, you know, almost 15 years now, that you have this issue with Israel. First, it was a genocide in Gaza. Then, of course, always what's happening in the West Bank. But now with Lebanon, and so you know, it's just not how the Lebanese and Hezbollah, but also the Lebanese in general, are going to respond, but how others are going to respond. And so, why aren't the Turks now considering other options? I don't think we're going to see Turkish F-16s over Beirut or the Bekaa Valley or anything like that. But certainly this idea of the Turks being a funneling weapons and support to Hezbollah I think that's a foregone conclusion at this point. You know, I mean, so, you know, it's just not how the Hezbollah reacted. Also, too, you see the Lebanese government, what you can, you know, the Lebanese government is really, I guess, a caretaker government's the right way to describe it. It's a shell. There's nothing really there. But at least, but their reaction and the unity it could bring among the Lebanese people, you know, so the consequences of this strategically are unsound for Israel. How does this further enable Israel's security, its stability, its safety? It doesn't. And, you know, Netanyahu over the weekend also made a big to do right before these attacks about the fourth goal of our operations now against Hamas are to bring our people back to their homes in northern Israel. So he explicitly and clearly links Gaza to Lebanon. And then as well, you see throughout Israel, many don't agree with this, but many do, this idea of the necessity of an invasion of Lebanon for the third time, right? For the third time in 40 years, essentially, maybe third time's a charm for the Israelis, who knows, right? I mean, why they think that, I can't tell you. But this idea that we need to push into Lebanon for security reasons, right? And certainly if you're on the militarist security side of Netanyahu's coalition, as well as those who are not in his coalition, because many of them are in lockstep, they're just not as obscene as Netanyahu and his governing coalition are, So if you're on the militarist side of that equation, the militant nationalists, if you will, you know, this idea of going into Lebanon to get that buffer, right? Push Hezbollah back north along above the Litani River, give us that buffer. Okay, this is appealing to you. This makes sense to you. It makes sense on a map. So many of these military mindset. Charlie Chaplin in The Great Dictator called them machine men, right? Machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. Brutes, he called them. You look at those in Israel who aren't of the religious caste, but of this militarist caste. That's who these people are, you know. And of course, for the religious side of this, for the settler side of it, for the Zionist Greater Israel side of it, this idea of expanding into Israel, into Lebanon, excuse me, has always been a part of their agenda. So here's now your chance. So now the fruits of October 7th are really starting to multiply. You had your ability to ethnically cleanse Gaza, which was further reinforced because, again, over the weekend, busy weekend with statements from Netanyahu, which is not an accident with the UN General Assembly coming up as well as with the UN General Assembly's actions last week. And I think, of course, that UN General Assembly resolution that vast majority of the world voted for, only 12 nations stood with the U.S. and Israel against that resolution, that UN General Assembly resolution that called for Israel to end its occupation of Palestine and also called on member states to sanction, blockade, embargo Israel. I think that plays into the use of this pager walkie-talkie attack in Lebanon and then this seeing through of the steps needed to get into this war with Lebanon. But what you also heard Netanyahu say this weekend, supposedly at a staff meeting at a conference, was that this idea, what they call the general's plan, this came up by a couple or two or three retired generals, of ethnically cleansing the north of Gaza, pushing the Palestinians south in the Netzarim corridor. So you're starting to see, okay, now you've got the big arrows coming out. Now you're starting to see their strategic goals coming out. What's Israel want to try and accomplish in the next 2 or 3 months? We're barely a month away from the American elections. So what do they want to try and accomplish before the elections? What do they want to lock in place by the time the elections are over? What do they want to have become a fait accompli by the time the next president is sworn in? And I think that might be fairly meaningless because with Harris or Trump, they're getting the same, thing. So, but, this idea of seeing this fourth part of the war against Hamas, as they would call it, now being this return of settlers to the north of Israel. Well, that then means that we have to do something to allow that to happen. And that means not just bombing Hezbollah, not just terrorizing the Lebanese population, but also as well putting our troops in the ground to have this buffer zone. And where that goes, how far they've gave that out, how much they've thought about the second, third, fourth steps involved in that process, or the order of effects, who knows. But it seems, I think we're a little more clearer today than when we talked 2 weeks ago about what is Israel going to do? What is the Netanyahu? What are their next clear moves? I mean, we know the tit for tat with Lebanon. We know the continuing genocide in Gaza. We know continuing to turn the screw on the Palestinians in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. But what are those big arrows? Where are they trying to go with this? And I think we've seen that. And of course, the ultimate goal is to get the U.S. to come in on their side when the war with Lebanon. Ultimately, a war with Iran, something again that the White House is terrified of because it would just for the fact that it could spike oil prices to the point that we're paying $7 or $8 a gallon gasoline here in the U.S. And then Harris loses. So in this time, while they have this lame duck who is also in Joe Biden, who is also completely afraid, though, of upsetting Israel, because this is the time to do it. Once the American elections happen, then you lose your pressure. Then you lose the value of the pro-Israel lobby, of the AIPAC and the other lobbies. So now in the next 6 weeks is when you really have to try and take advantage of your operation, of your control of the American political system. So, you know, this is their opportunity to do that now. I think in the next 6 weeks. And so I think we'll see major things coming from Israel, as if these things haven't been major enough, right? But more solidification of what they want to try and have in place by election day, and then what cannot be undone by the time the next president comes into office.
Just today, or maybe yesterday, Netanyahu sent a video message to Lebanese people, in which he's trying to separate people of Lebanon from Hezbollah. And here is the video. Just look at it.
People of Lebanon, Israel's war is not with you. It's with Hezbollah. For too long, Hezbollah has been using you as human shields. It placed rockets in your living rooms and missiles in your garage. Those rockets and missiles are aimed directly at our cities, directly at our citizens. To defend our people against Hezbollah strikes, we must take out those weapons. Now, starting this morning, the IDF has warned you to get out of harm's way. I urge you, take this warning seriously. Don't let Hezbollah endanger your lives and the lives of your loved ones. Don't let Hezbollah endanger Lebanon. Please, get out of harm's way now. Once our operation is finished, you can come back safely to your homes.
Yeah, it's unbelievable how it's so simple-minded if you think this way. And he thinks that he can influence the people in Lebanon.
Well, I don't know, Nima. Do you think they even bother to translate into Arabic? Do you think they even bother to distribute it to the Lebanese channels? You know what I mean, in the sense that that was entirely for the American Congress. What you just saw there are the talking points for the next 2 to 3 weeks on U.S. television networks, in the major American corporate media, and in the halls of Congress. That's what that was. I can't imagine anyone in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem or wherever they filmed this for 1 second believe any Lebanese is going to pay any attention to it. If not, you know, and if any of them are, they're probably going to throw their shoes at the television, you know what I mean? So like, that's what propaganda is for. We often think of propaganda trying to change minds, and oftentimes propaganda is meant to reinforce minds. And that's what you saw there. You all saw clear communication of what are the talking points. And if you go on Twitter now, you can find all types of American commentators, British commentators as well, I'm sure French and German, you know, I mean, whoever, who are saying, look at Netanyahu did. Netanyahu went on television. He begged these people to leave their homes so that they wouldn't be killed. But what are you going to do? They've got rockets and missiles in their homes. You can't, because those rockets and missiles are being used to strike Haifa. And they're, you know, on and on and on. You can see just the arguments, whether it's on Twitter, whether it's in the newspapers, whether it's on CNN and Fox and MSNBC, that come directly from this speech. And Netanyahu is very good at what he's, I mean, again, give credit where credit's due. Mossad did an incredible operation with that. I mean, heinous as it was, and as ultimately counterproductive as it was, and this, other than, you know, getting the cheerleading going in the U.S., particularly, you know, you've got the U.N. General Assembly coming up. And again, I think a lot of this was timed. I think some of the timing was accidental. Again, seemed as if Hezbollah had found these devices and were, you know, so the Israelis had the mindset of use it or lose it. But, you know, and then again, in this case, too, the talking points being distributed, the information that people, that the believers on your side need to know, you know, as we say, you know, the English English adage about teaching the choir the words to the hymn. You know, that's essentially what he's doing here. And so he's very good at that. He's very good at that.
Matt, do you think when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine, everybody was arguing since this conflict started that there is a huge lack of Russian analysts in Washington who understand the situation that they're mm-hmm. and they're not making on based on ideological views? And yeah. How about the Middle East, Matt? What do we know about the Middle East? How about the intelligence coming from there? And how powerful is Washington in gathering information from the Middle East? And how about the Middle Eastern analysts?
Yeah,
who understand the situation there?
Yeah, that's a really good point to bring up, Nima. You know, I'm reminded that this happens in the 50s in the U.S., where led by Joe McCarthy, but there are certainly others within the U.S. government and foreign policy community and within the elites that wanted to see this happen. Anyone who knew anything about China was purged from the U.S. government, particularly the State Department, where they had people who really understood China, realized what was occurring there, what could occur there, and they were purged. And you've had particularly over the decades, and it really starts, I think, in the 50s, a politicization of the American Foreign Service community and our intelligence community that just every decade expands upon itself, right? It just reinforces itself. So, of course, the knife is put in the chest of any type of objective analysis coming from either diplomats or intelligence officers by Dick Cheney, you know, in the months and in weeks before the invasion of Iraq. Right, where it just becomes clear that the only thing you can provide is the intelligence that they want to hear. The only type of analysis you can provide is what matches up with their narrative. And I saw this as someone who was in D.C. and as a through Forrest Gump-like experiences, like I've said, got to see some fairly senior decision making and process. And that's what it was. If you were bringing into the table in that room did not match up with what the boss wanted. I'm talking about the principals here. So you're talking about the vice president, the secretary of state, the secretary of defense, et cetera. If what you were going to say didn't match up with what they wanted, didn't match up with that narrative, don't say it. It's not welcome in this room. You're just going to get yourself, you know, a lot of dirty looks, and someone's going to talk to you afterwards, and then no, you're not going to be allowed to speak again, and eventually you're going to get signed to something else. You know, that's the way it was. And now, of course, years on, you know, and you see, well, I'll give you an example. They had in the Hill, the newspaper in the U.S., the last couple of days, they've published who's likely to be in Donald Trump's cabinet, who's likely to be in Kamala Harris's cabinet. And you see just people who have failed over and over and over again, particularly on the Democratic side. I started to say Michelle Flournoy because she's a top pick to be Harris's Secretary of Defense. Flournoy is the one who was the architect of the U.S. surge in Afghanistan. She is the one who was full hog, full throated, full bore on Libya. Same with Syria, right? And on, you could pick out however many other disastrous things that she has advocated for when she wasn't in a position of power, when she wasn't a part of the American government. You know, same thing with Bill Burns in its article. I swear, Neiman, this is true. Look it up if you want. It talks about how Bill Burns is most likely to be the next Secretary of State. And these comments come from an analyst at Brookings who, I'm not going to say his name, but people can figure it out, look it up, who has been wrong on everything. And the only reason he continues to have this type of stature is because he's like dinner partners with David Petraeus. And that's the way it's been for 20 years, because he's been wrong on everything for 20 years. But the, you know, Bill, what they say about Bill Burns in this, and I swear, folks, is what it says. It says Bill Burns was the person that Joe Biden turned to negotiate with the Taliban in the summer of 2021. He's the person that Joe Biden turned to stop Vladimir Putin from invading Ukraine. He's a person who has been at the forefront of ceasefire negotiations with Israel and Hamas. I mean, those are three massive, abject, clear, and costly failures. And The Hill is advertising that this is what a real resume looks like to be the Secretary of State. So if you want to succeed in Washington, you have to fail magnificently in order to demonstrate your loyalty that allows you to rise. And so even when you get down to the kind of the nuts and bolts of this, okay, well, what type of intelligence is being collected? Certainly the American technical intelligence is very good in terms of our ability to eavesdrop, read people's emails, use our satellites to look at things, use our satellites to read signatures coming off of it, emissions or radiation or what have you, right? All types of technical means of gathering intelligence. That, of course, has to be analyzed, right? Because very rarely do you get intelligence like that, that's raw intelligence that tells you the actual story. Unless it's you know, there's no context, there's no background. I mean, I had a conversation with the ambassador and the deputy ambassador to Afghanistan when I was leaving, and we had bugged Hamid Karzai's office and this is in 2009, so we heard everything Karzai said. And the way they talked about this intelligence, well, did Karzai know we have bugged his office? Because you guys don't seem to even think you've even considered that. Because he's saying exactly what you want him to say. And it turns out wasn't how things played out otherwise, right? I mean, so if you don't have analysts who understand that and are willing to understand that, your technical intelligence can only be so good. And then, of course, our on-ground, our intelligence on the ground, whether it be from human intelligence, like in terms of our spies, our assets, if you will, those who work for us. You know, what I saw in Iraq and Afghanistan was pathetic, absolutely pathetic. Just essentially, we're going on the words of people who want to collaborate with us primarily because we're going to pay them. I mean, the number of intelligence reports we'd see that would come in from a human source that was just completely wrong. Or, I mean, I had this experience, peers of mine had an experience. You'd be in a room in a meeting with your Iraqi or Afghan counterparts, and then you'd see like a readout, intel readout later about that same meeting. And that wasn't said. Where the heck did that come from? Or yes, that was said, but that's not what that was meant. You know, I mean, in the parochialism within these organizations that they can't, we're the best, we're the Americans. What could these people say or what could these people do? Who could be better than us? I had working for me when I was in Iraq in 04 and 05. At one point, I had 3,000 Iraqis working for me. And I went to the CIA folks and I said, look, I've got this. What can I do to help you guys out? I can get you all kinds of information. And these are people who want to help us, right? I mean, we have to be careful that they would get, you know, corrupted or they get flipped or whatever. But for the most part, you know, these are people who are on our side. You know, God bless them, the false hope we gave them, right? You know, and, you know, the response back from the CIA was, why would we do that? They're not our people. You know, I mean, it was just that type of, and then in a more traditional sense of what the diplomats are doing, you look at most of the American embassies now, they're fortresses. They're completely cut off from the people that they are, the population in which they are embedded. I mean, so particularly in the Middle East, Lebanon, I think, is a great example, because if I remember correctly, the American embassy was moved well outside the city, outside of Beirut. It's up on a hill and it's got gates and moats and alligators with lasers on their foreheads type of thing. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, in the sense that they are so far removed and they're so unable to maneuver within the population that how do they know what's going on? And so very often what happens is that our folks, whether they're diplomats, intel officers, military officers, what they know comes strictly from the people who are on our payroll. So, I mean, you have this type of, are we getting the information we're getting without context, without background, without our own people actually getting our eyes on it. We have a parochialized system that won't take inputs from anything that's its own, because not because they've got a well-established credible method of vetting, but because they're just of a chauvinism, right? And then, of course, people are telling us what we want to hear. And so I think that's why, you know, even if our intelligence at this point wasn't so politicized, so you've got this crap coming in, right, that needs to get, you know, unbroken and find a gem out of that. But the process to find the gem is inherently rotten and corrupted, because what they know the bosses want is the politicized stuff. And even if you do have something that's not politicized, well, you have what happened, say, in 2015, when you had 50 intelligence officers down at the U.S. Central Command, U.S. Central Command in Florida, which is the headquarters for U.S. Middle Eastern operations, who went to the inspector general. And they said, our boss, General Lloyd Austin, who would then go on to Raytheon and then come back as a Secretary of Defense, that he was changing the intelligence. That what we were giving General Austin about the war in Syria, he was changing it to make it more appreciated by the White House and then passing it on to Barack Obama. You have 50 intelligence officers. And of course, nothing happened. The IG reviewed it. Austin didn't do anything wrong, et cetera, et cetera. He goes on to Raytheon. He goes on to be our Secretary of Defense now. You know, so you can see how just the whole system is corrupt and rotten. And as I said before, with talks about Flournoy being sec def, Burns being sec state, well, the only way you get ahead is to just prove your loyalty. And I mean, that's maybe it's always been true in Washington, D.C., that's the highest and most prized attribute is loyalty. But, you know, you see what you run into. You know, and this extends in the military as well. The 3- and 4-star generals are surrounded by sycophants. They're surrounded by people who will only tell them what they want to hear. The same thing in Congress. They are surrounded by people who are only going to tell them what they want to hear. And also, too, you have now the issues of who's actually able to go in there and talk to the members of Congress. So even if you have honest members of Congress, the chances that you are going to be getting information that's decent for them, or easy, or digestible, or useful for them to use. I mean, I could tell you all kinds of different stories about working on the Afghan war and getting into these offices and telling them information that they just didn't know. I mean, I remember one time Senator Franken's office telling them, look, since General Petraeus has taken over, since General McChrystal has taken over, every month that we've been in this war in Afghanistan, our casualties have gotten worse. And they said, oh, no. General Petraeus was just here the other day, and he was saying that since he's taken over, casualties have gone down. And myself and my friend Matt, I'm not organized. Matt pulls out of his, looks at his thing, pulls out of his attaché case. Here's the casualty statistics from the Department of Defense. And you can see clearly they've gone up, especially under General Petraeus, right? And this was news to these people. You know, another quick story, I went in, saw Ike Skelton, who was the chair of the House Armed Services Committee, and this was March of 2010. And I just told this story on another podcast the other day, so if people heard this already, forgive me. But, I go in to see Chairman Skelton, and he's the chair of the House Armed Services Committee. That means he is the most senior person in the House of Representatives, the People's House, for oversight on America's military and its wars. And this is, again, 2010. So this is 8.5 years since we've been in Afghanistan. And I give my assessment of the situation in Afghanistan. I tell him what I think the surge in Afghanistan is going to accomplish. And he, thanks me, asks me a couple of questions. And then he says, you're the first person who's ever come in this office and give me a negative briefing on Afghanistan. So the whole thing is corrupted. So even those who want to hear the right information, they can't get it. And I think I've told you before, same thing. I had to go in and testify to the President's Intelligence Advisory Board because former Senators Chuck Hagel and David Boren, how come what you're saying is not matching up with what's going on in the President's desk? It's also in agreement with everything we're hearing from, mid and senior level officers who are willing to speak about this candidly. So we have a real issue here where the narrative that underlies the empire in all different ways just precludes the actual operations of the empire because it's too politically costly to allow, things to be done effectively or efficiently or correctly.
Yeah. And one of the things that you've mentioned, Matt, I think is so important to understand the behavior of Netanyahu and his administration is how they see the situation to bring Iran into the conflict. Mm. And with the new government and with the policies that we're witnessing from Iran, I don't see that coming. What Netanyahu is asking for, it wants to have, I don't see that coming from Iran. Iran is not looking for any sort of escalation right now.
Yeah.
The foreign minister of Iran right now in New York, he wants to talk with Washington. He wants to talk with Blinken and they're looking for some sort of political solution for anything that they're having with Washington. And at the same time, you see Netanyahu doing his best in order to escalate the tensions with Hezbollah.
Right.
And the question is right now, does Netanyahu understand what would be the Iran's policy? Because when it comes to, you have to understand what Iran really wants right now at this particular moment, that as I've talked, that they're not looking for escalations. But the question is, how do they see it in Israel?
Yeah, I think what they want, what he wants is he wants the drama of it. He wants a theater of it. I think he is smart enough to know he's not going to get regime change out of this, but I think he believes he can hurt them and he can make an example of them. And that somehow by the brute strength, he will attract support politically, domestically, of course, also the crisis of the war to bolster his own political circumstances. But, I think he also thinks that somehow this has been a policy of Israel since its foundation, the Iron Wall policy, that you're going to be such a brute, you're going to carry such a heavy stick that no one will threaten you. That, and so I think he also has on a personal legacy note, he has spent his entire life. I mean, I've known this guy for 30 years or whatever, right? You know, about the boogeyman of Iran. I mean, it's been more than 20 years since, I think it was like 98. It's more than 25 years. He stood in the UN with that, you know, cartoon, you know, cannonball, the fuse, right? With this is how close Iran is to getting a nuclear weapon. I mean, so, you know, I mean, this is his life's purpose, his life's mission. And so if he can punish them, I don't think he thinks he's going to get regime change or anything like that, like the neoconservatives in the United States, you know, believe so fabulously. But, you know, I think he thinks that the stick is enough for him. You know, and I think what he could get, I think what he envisions happening is the Americans showing up with four aircraft carriers, a dozen destroyers, a dozen frigates, six or seven cruisers, a handful of subs, right? And sending over 30 batteries of Patriot missiles, right? I mean, like that type of thing. Almost all of our F-35, F-15, F-16 squadrons and so forth. And that essentially they're going to be protected from any of these missile attacks from Iran, from Yemen. And I think this Axis of Resistance should have kind of tripped him up a bit in showing how determined they are and how their ability able to strike. But he's committed to it. And I think that's what he wants to see, is to see this full-throated American presence there that's going to allow him to beat Iran, you know, with a stick, essentially, just because it's going to make him feel good, right? Essentially for those reasons, right? Because he's a brute. He's a psychopath. He's a war criminal. He's a genocidist. All these things. And on the bottom of it, he's a politician. And so his calculations are, this is best for me politically. And if we happen to lose 100, 1,000, 10,000 Israelis from Axis of Resistance missiles, well, so be it. That's the cost of that. That's what our survival entails. You know what I mean? So I think that's what he's looking for. And he's looking at, and I think the moment now, as we were saying earlier, is really key in the sense that you have this lame duck president, Joe Biden, who also is terrified that something's going to happen that's going to ruin Harris's chances in November, which is, again, only six weeks away into the election, essentially. So can they get through that without something occurring? You know, that's what the White House is holding its breath on, because they will have to submit to Netanyahu. They will have to come to Israel's defense. I think this is what one of the goals of the pager attacks was, to cause such a backlash from Hezbollah to cause Americans to be up in arms and to say, oh, we have to support. Because right now, the majority of American people are not saying that the United States should support Israel in a conflict with Iran or Hezbollah or whoever. And so the idea being is that it get the United States to be put in those circumstances. And then, of course, you know, I'm sure right now, AIPAC and the other pro-Israel lobbies are saying to the White House, the DNC, to the Congress, but look, we got 6 weeks left. We got hundreds of millions of dollars left to spend. You know, how should we spend this money? And so you get the Biden here on the horns of a dilemma where, if I allow Netanyahu, if I go along with it and he gets his war with this regional war and it causes gas prices to spike, Harris loses the election. If I don't go along with him, well, then you know what? AIPAC and their buddies, all the other Israeli lobby buddies, are going to start throwing their money to the Trump campaign. And that's what's going to hurt Harris. It's also going to hurt all our down ballot elections. You know, forget about Tester winning in Montana. We're going to make sure he loses. You guys are going to lose control of the Senate. You know, the balance in the House is not great. You know, good luck trying to get to win that then. You know, and now at least you're only five or six votes below the majority. But how's it going to feel when you're 15? You know, now you're going to have a Trump in the White House with a solid House. And, you know, and the Republicans, yeah, we'll get rid of the filibuster. You know, we're willing to play that game, which is stupid why the Democrats didn't do it, because eventually the Republicans will. So, I mean, those are the choices I think that the White House is looking at right now. And I don't feel any sympathy for them. I feel sympathy for the people who are going to be killed because of this, who have been killed for it, regardless of where they are. I feel sympathy for the Israelis who are going to get killed because of what's coming. You know, no one deserves this, because look at who benefits from it. You know, whether it's Netanyahu or in some ways Trump or Harris, you know. So, yeah, I mean, the where we were at historically is another aspect of what comes further. You know, is this just one footnote? It's going to be a couple paragraphs in a history of the Middle East in years to come. Or is this the opening? Is this the grand finale of the book? Or is this going to be, and this is what I think, it's going to be the opening chapters. The example I use is the Balkans War that preceded the First World War, where over a million people died. There was ethnic cleansing during that. I mean, it's mass atrocities in 1912 and 1913. Horror upon horror. If you went back, people were saying, we've never seen anything like this. Only just wait a year, see what happens next year. You know, and that's what I'm afraid. Is this where we're at? Is that, and please no one mistake me for what I'm saying here, is Gaza simply just that, the opening act, where people are going to forget about the genocide in Gaza because what comes next is so much worse. And, you know, that's what I'm afraid of.
Yeah. Matt, shifting the gear to the conflict in Ukraine, we have Zelensky's victory plan.
What's your understanding? We can't even do this with a straight face. It's such a serious thing. We shouldn't laugh, you know, people suffering. But I mean, oh, God, yeah.
What's your understanding of this plan? And how, because one of the points in this plan is an invitation coming from Biden to invite Ukraine being part of NATO.
Yeah.
Is that they're seeing that being part of NATO would facilitate their way of being part of the EU.
Yeah, and certainly there is, you know, the EU is building out this armed aspect, this militarized part of the EU, and Ukraine being a component of that, we've heard talk about as well. So not just joining NATO, but also joining this militarized vehicle of the EU, which I don't understand. I mean, I do understand it because the EU itself wants prominence. It wants the relative. It wants to be relative. It wants to be meaningful, and it wants the money as well, because there's a lot of money in having your own personal NATO, right? It's a great racket. But you know, this victory plan. I think we've probably, when it finally is unveiled tomorrow, I believe. We're talking on Monday. Zelensky is supposed to speak on Tuesday, I believe. He has promised to unveil it to the United States president first. So I don't assume he's going to, unless he's already met with Joe Biden or is meeting with him, because he's here in the U.S. already. So maybe he'll have already met with President Biden before. I don't know. But maybe we'll see it tomorrow during his address to the General Assembly. I think it's going to look a lot like what we've already seen before. You know, this asking for more. We need more wonder weapons. So we need the extended range JASSM missile, right, which is about 600 miles. Eventually, in that you can read, they're going to ask for the Tomahawk missiles next, right? We're going to need more. Wonder weapon. Certainly the economic support they're going to request, the continued, because from my understanding, it's got four elements to it. It's got an economic element, a military element, a diplomatic element. And I forget what off the top of my head, I forget what the fourth one is. But the diplomatic element, of course, would be this further sanctions on Russia, et cetera. But as well as then this idea of bringing NATO into Ukraine into NATO. Ultimately, the goal is to get NATO into Ukraine, right? Isn't that the goal? And so, you know, I've heard in a couple of places or a couple of podcasts, people talking about they want to see Ukraine and NATO by the end of this year, right? That will be the ask. So I think there might be some things that we find interesting or amusing, but I think for the most part, it will be what we've already seen before, in a sense of what his asks are going to be or his demands. You know, I think you could, you know, he described at one point that the Kursk operation was the first element in this plan, you know, so maybe that's what he's proposing, more offensives. And in order to do these offensives, I need more things. The reason why we're not succeeding in Kursk is because we don't have enough air defense assets to protect our troops there from, you know, the glide bombs. And so that, of course, is picked up and run on back here in the U.S., where it's, look, if the Ukrainians had enough air defense missiles, they would be expanding that salient. They would be expanding their incursion in curse. They really be putting, you know, and so it what was troubling is it, I think it was in The Hill, maybe it was in Politico I read today, the description of Biden's interaction in all this as determining his legacy. This is something we've seen continually, particularly since he announced he wasn't running again. What's his legacy going to be? And Ukraine is going to be what his legacy is. This will be his final act. This will define the man for time to come. And of course, they throw in, is he the one who stood up to the dictator or backed down? Did he betray Ukraine or did he help them win their freedom? I saw that Zelensky was going to Pennsylvania. And my first thought was, oh my God, please, please do not let him go to Valley Forge, you know, which would have been a brilliant public relations propaganda media opportunity for him. For people not familiar, Valley Forge is a couple of years into the American Revolution. I'm trying to remember what year. Was it 1776? I'm trying to remember. Anyway, but Valley Forge, the American army, George Washington's army is falling apart. The guys are soldiers are walking away. The warrants, their contracts were expiring. They had no money to keep these guys in the army. They couldn't feed them. They were in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, and they were freezing. I mean, terrible. And Washington gives a great speech, rallies the troops, crosses the river, you know, takes 10,000 or 15,000 Hessian troops prisoner, turns the war around. You know, so you can imagine Zelensky making that kind of thing at Valley Forge and then going on to this is why we need all these things. That's the same point, too, where, you know, you start to see the American diplomatic efforts having a lot of fruit in terms of, saying, getting the French to support us during our revolution, which is an aspect that most Americans, we tend to leave out how important the French were to us winning that thing. Yeah, we'll see. I think we talked a couple weeks ago about what I think he needs to do, in the sense that he needs to go to BlackRock, he needs to go to State Street, he needs to go to Vanguard, to Goldman Sachs, as well as to Raytheon, Lockheed, you know, and the others. And with the banks, say, hey, you were promised this reconstruction. This is hundreds of billions of dollars for you. And to the weapons companies, you have tens and tens of billions of dollars lined up here in future contracts that if my government collapses, you're not going to get. And the same to the banks. If my government collapses, you're not getting any reconstruction. So you've got to keep us afloat. You got to tell the president that he needs to A, B, and C. You know, I mean, so I think we'll probably see some of that as well. But eventually, I think at the I know I said this already, but eventually what we're just going to see tomorrow and the rest of this week is what we've already seen before. Maybe he'll surprise us. I mean, he's a good artist. He's a good comedian, I guess, understands how to do the theater, you know, so maybe he'll give us a surprise.
Whenever we talk about Ukraine, Matt, just to wrap up this session, everybody's talking about how the United States, together with the United Kingdom, was forcing Ukrainian not to negotiate, go fight in Russia. But at the end of the day, who's responsible, I think, is Zelensky and his administration. Because nobody gonna say that we're gonna kill you unless you fight Russians. And these are huge decisions on their part, because he was the president of Ukraine. Official president, he was deciding to go to war with Russia, and he could have some sort of resistance against any sort of policy coming out of the United Kingdom or the United States. But people, we tend to just ignore the role of Zelensky and what he did and his administration did to his own country. A guy that you mentioned, a comedian, came out of nowhere, and nobody knows where he's gonna go, and because these people are, Matt, it's so important for the people of Ukraine, for the future of Ukraine. Yeah. If they wanna live together, they have to understand that what Zelensky and his administration did is so much outrage, unbelievable.
Yeah, I remind people that it was about 2 years ago that Zelensky was Time's Man of the Year. And then the following year, just about a year ago now, Time had a cover story on him where his own people and his own inner circle were telling Time's correspondent that this guy's delusional. He's got a messiah complex. I think he's a tragic figure in the Greek sense, a man who tried to fly too high and, of course, was, you know, through his own as well as others' machinations brought down. I think you see a man who may have, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt, because when he runs and wins election, he's running on an anti-corruption and a I'm going to make peace in the East. You know, I'm going to talk to Putin and, you know, where that changed. How willing was he? I mean, you hear these stories that supposedly the far right, the neo-Nazis came into his office and said, hey, that's the tree over there we're going to hang you from if you make a deal with Putin, if you even talk to them. The Americans and the British, not so obscene or vulgar, but similar. And certainly when this war occurs, when the invasion takes place, Zelensky's instincts are correct. He immediately says, you know what, it's war is not worth it. It's not worth being in this war to be a part of NATO. Neutrality is worth it. We can do neutrality. He says it immediately. And of course, the negotiations begin. And then, of course, they get to the point where they have a draft agreement. Both of the negotiating teams, the Russian and the Ukrainian, have signed off on it, you know, initialed off on it. And now it's really just down to this peace deal being submitted and having a summit between the two presidents. And it doesn't happen because the Americans and the Brits stop it. One of the ways they stop it is by whispering into Zelensky's ear, we're going to give you everything you need. You are going to be the Churchill of your era. This is going to be your legacy. This is going to be the greatest role you've ever played. And he accepts it. And is it because he fell for this false hope? He really did believe that he was engaged in a struggle for his country's freedom, that there are all types of historical there meanings to this, that this goes back hundreds of years. Certainly, I'm sure there's some of it. Some of it, though, I think was that messiah complex, was that ego of this would be the greatest role I could play. And of course, the Americans and Brits giving them all the false hope of like, you know, we know this. We know the Russians better than you do. They're going to collapse. This is how it's going to work. We've learned if Zelensky said, well, what about, you know, country A, Iraq, Afghanistan, Vietnam, Libya, Syria? They would say, we've learned all the lessons. We understood what happened there. And this is where it's going to work. Right. You know, I mean, those types of things would have been said to him. And so did he accept it because he believed it, or did he accept it because he wanted to believe it, because he saw the grandeur, his own legacy, this greatest role of all time that he could play? We also have to remember that this is a man who was corrupt right away while in office. If it was the Paradise Papers or the Panama Papers, I'm forgetting the two. But they documented in 2019, it was, maybe it was in 2020, the extent of Zelensky's corruption, that he had and his cronies, his friends, had more than $1 billion stashed overseas. You know, so we know that this man was corrupt from the get out. You know, so that kind of precludes any sympathy you might have for him, that he was trying to do the right thing, that he believed in this false hope. You know, he probably did believe in the false hope. He probably really did think that the United States and Brits were going to give him everything, NATO were going to give him everything they needed. He probably believed in their assessments and everything else. So, yeah, I mean, you could see him as a tragic figure if you start with him as the man who runs for office, right, on this anti-corruption and peace platform, giving him the benefit of the doubt that that's where he was. And it seems to be that's what he really did at that point believe. But then history hit him in the face and those things changed. And he now dealt with the great powers and he was part of the big hand movement of history. And if it wasn't going to be Zelensky, it was going to be somebody else that was going to lead Ukraine into this war. That was for certain. Zelensky could have been replaced at any time by someone who was more than willing to bring this destruction on his people. So I don't want to assign blame to one person because I believe blame is like the sun, Nima, right? You and I can both receive the sunlight without me taking any from you and you taking any from me. And that's how blame works. Blame can go around. Just because I assign blame to Zelensky or I assign blame to Biden or assign blame to Putin, there's enough blame. No one's detracting from anyone else's blame. So that's how I kind of see it. And now this point we're at here now with this steadfastness, this desire to win an unwinnable war, any cost, including the risk of escalation, which we've only seen heightened. And that's one thing that I do fear. People were pleased 2 weeks ago when Joe Biden said that we're not going to provide these longer range. We're not going to allow the Ukraine to use our attack of missiles and by extension, the British Storm Shadow missiles to fire deeper into Russia. And while there's some argument out there that, well, they're just going to prove it in private like they've done other times with other missiles and other weapon systems. But the other thing, too, is for me, I think maybe this is a case of getting our messaging synchronized. So rather than have this announcement take place and have this thing occur 2 weeks before the UN General Assembly, why don't we do it correctly and properly and in a great public relations manner and have it lined up so that Zelensky says, this is what I need. And then Joe Biden solidifying his legacy as a champion of democracy and as an opponent of tyrants can step forward and said, here are your attackums. And of course, the next day, what are they going to say? Where are the extended range JASMs? Where are the Tomahawks? You know, and it's completely militarily meaningless. I've said this other places. People who don't know, when we got air support in Iraq and Afghanistan, those planes sometimes came from bases in Iraq and Afghanistan, many times came from places hundreds or thousands of miles away. I remember being in Tikrit in 04 and hearing F-15s come down the Tigris River. They're heading down to Fallujah. They were coming out of Insular Air Base in Turkey. You know, I mean, anytime we had, I remember B-1s over us in Afghanistan, they were coming out of Diego Garcia. You know, the F-15s would come out of Al Udeid in the Persian Gulf, right? I mean, like, so, yeah, this idea that the Russians don't have fuel tanks for their aircraft, first of all, their aircraft can't fly that far, which, you know, they don't have aerial fueling and they can't do the same thing we did. I mean, you could push these airplanes all the way past Moscow, past the Ural Mountains. They're still going to be able to drop their glide bombs 40 kilometers from where they need to drop them from in Ukraine. So the whole idea of it is just moronic, you know. But this is the path we're on, and we're on a, you know, we always come to this point where we're wrapping up. We're on an incredibly dangerous path, and one day I'm really afraid that saying that is going to be, you know, worthless saying it because we've already hit that point.
Thank you so much, Matt, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
Yeah, thank you, Nima. I appreciate it.